Atheist Nomads, episode 135, Geologic with George Traub.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
We are the Atheist Nomads, bringing you history, science, politics, religion, and interviews with leaders in the atheist community. Not all those who wander are lost. Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin. Joining me as always is Wesley.
Hey there, hi there, ho there.
And joining us today is George Traub of the Geologic Podcast and Blog, drummer from the Philadelphia Funk Authority, frequent MC at conferences like the Amazing Meeting, QED, and Australian Skeptics Convention, and also, I think, the most frequent guest on the SGU.
I think so. I don't know if Phil Plait has me beat, maybe, but I think it's me. I think I will take that crown humbly. Hello, gents. How's it going?
Why
nomads? Why atheist nomads? What's the history of that name? Tell me. Explain it. Tell me.
So, that'd be on me. In the summer of 2007, when I was about to drop out of the Seventh Adventist Theological Seminary, I was
boring.
Spent 6 weeks in Jordan, followed by 3 weeks in Mexico, where I was preaching an evangelistic series, and quit four sermons in on that series, and left religion, and started the rest of my journey to being an atheist. And when I was needing to find a screen name a little bit later for, I don't remember what site it was, I was thinking about what to go with, and I really liked the nomads, like the Bedouins, and I was in a temporary position living in Tacoma and likely to move, and I was getting antsy to move again, and I decided I was going to go by DW Nomad Online, started a blog, and then Wesley started blogging there, and then we started the podcast and called it Atheist Nomads.
That's a hell of a travel agent to go from Jordan to Mexico. That's like, wow.
I had an overnight stay in Chicago between the two.
Even better.
Think of him like a grasshopper from Kung Fu.
What was really weird with that transition was the thing that shocked me the most. Well, okay, went from dry air to humid air, and brown people had exposed limbs, and men and women were holding hands instead of men holding hands with men.
Well, as you do in the Middle East.
That was what ended up seeming weird to me.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And that was it. That's when you said, I'm done. I'm out.
God's not real.
I can't take it anymore.
I preached four sermons and didn't believe a single word and decided I couldn't keep doing it.
God, so what's that like? So what's that like when you're like, what, an hour-long sermon? Half hour? How long?
They're about an hour.
Hour-long sermon, right? Oh, with a translator. Oh, even better. So you get to say the thing and then they get to translate. So you get to like feel bad about it twice within your own sermon.
Oh, especially by the fourth one when my Spanish was not only had all come back, but was getting better. And I was actually understanding most of the words the translator was saying.
Right. Hipocritico. Right. Yeah. Stuff like that.
Man. Nice. Yeah. Did an altar call. Nobody came forward and was like, okay, if I'm right, I am doing nobody any good here. And if I'm wrong, I'm also not doing anybody any good. I need to quit.
What was the topic of, was it the same topic for all four?
Those were four parts in a 27-part series covering the Adventist message. And that first four sermons was really, well, first three was kind of the standard evangelical Christian message of we can know things because of the Bible, and the Bible is accurate, and Jesus loves you and wants to save you from your sins, and you are a terrible, terrible sinner.
Right.
Obviously.
And then started going into more Adventist-specific stuff of the end is nigh and you need to get ready.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And
good for you, man. All right.
How about you? You're raised Catholic.
I was raised Catholic. Yeah, I was out very quick, though. I knew very quickly that it was kind of a bit of a Ponzi scheme from I think age 7 or 8. I kind of was really aware that this doesn't really make sense, and no one's explaining this really well. And I'm only 7. Like, why am I able to stump the priest? Why, you know, the priest that's supposedly working with this backup of 2,000 years worth of knowledge and study can be stumped by this 8-year-old, 9-year-old, maybe 10-year-old kid and has to go, some things we just don't know. And it's like, wait, no, wait a minute. I'm just post-fetus and I'm stumping 2,000 years of teachings. That's not cool. And then the hypocrisy of it all. And yeah, just realizing that. Plus I was an altar boy, which then that really then doubly made it. I was aware of the kind of hypocritical nature of the whole thing and how it really was just a show. Being altar boy was great because it made church go by faster. So there was that. Right. And then I didn't have to. I was busy. And then also, I've told this story before, but in my particular church, in the Ukrainian Catholic Greek Rite Church, communion is distributed through a single communal spoon, which is this sort of bacterial fiesta, and literally everybody lines up, and one priest with one spoon dips it into the chalice, grabs the crouton and the wine, and supposedly dunks it into everyone's mouth, but people are putting their full mouth onto this thing. So you're getting hundreds of people sharing this spoon. Just horrendous. So as an altar boy, worst case, I would be like third or fourth in line. So I was just playing my bacteriological odds. And then it also made the whole thing go by faster. I remember seeing the huge amounts of money because we had to count all the money that was brought in, after each service. And that also was just, you know, disheartening and disappointing. Seeing, people, spending money they should not be spending on this kind of stuff. And very disheartening. So I was out quick. And then once I was in college, I actually dated someone that was very religious. And so I kind of, read the Bible cover to cover in English. Because I was Ukrainian Catholic. So I sort of, Ukrainian Catholics don't ever read the Bible.
I want to unpack that a little bit more. Ukrainian Catholic Greek Rite.
Yeah. So it's not like Orthodox, but it's Ukrainian Catholic, which is like the Byzantine Rite, but we recognize that the Pope is the head of the church. So the Byzantine Orthodox don't recognize the Pope, but for whatever reason, just that alone right there, like I had friends that I was in, would go to camp with or was in Ukrainian school with, and like they were the non-Greek Rite. They were the Orthodox. And like just there, I was like, wait a minute. We're already splitting off from each other. Like there's already this difference in what the God is supposedly okay with or not okay with. Like we are it's like that famous Emo Phillips bit, you know, where he's on the bridge and he's about to jump and the guy, I'm not going to do any justice, but I think this was voted one of the best jokes of all time. But in essence, this guy is trying to prevent this other guy from killing himself. And he realizes that they have everything in common. They're both from the same state, the same city, the same town. They're the same religion. They're the same subset until they get to this final, you know, are you the proctory of 1850? And he's like, no, I'm the proctory of 1870. And he pushes him off the thing. Die, heretic, you know. Again, I'm not doing it any justice. Yeah, it's a great look up Emo Phillips, you know, bridge religion joke. It's really, really funny. But it's so true. Awesome. Yeah, it's so true. These minute, tiny differences that I would say, like, you know, why isn't my friend, you know, why isn't Mark from school at church here? And it would be explained to me, oh, well, he goes to the other Ukrainian Byzantine Catholic church that doesn't recognize the Pope, you know, and they use incense 4 times during the ceremony. We only use incense 3 times during the ceremony. And
Did your priest have a beard?
No, it's not the guys with the Jiffy Pop hats and the beards. Yeah, our guys were clean shaven and they didn't go for the hats.
Okay. So they were more Catholic for sure.
Yeah, so lots of gold, lots of incense, lots of icons, lots of mosaic tile. Very big on the mosaic tile. Lots of beautiful mosaic. The big golden gates at the front of the church. So like, you know, no one's allowed to walk through the center gate. Only the priest can. The altar boys can't. We had to use the side gates. We'd get in some deep, deep shit if we went through the center gate. That was a very, very bad. You had to confess that sin if you walked through the middle. So again, it was all smoke and mirrors. Like, it was all like getting it and behind the scenes, you knew it was all smoke and mirrors. So it was quite illuminating. So between that and then actually reading the Bible in English cover to cover, wanting to impress this girl, that's when I finally was like, that sort of solidified the whole deal when I realized, like, have you actually read this? This is terrible.
I got to add, though, I kind of can echo what you're talking about. You know, I was raised Southern Baptist for a fair piece, and, you know, all of our heads of the Southern Baptists, they have that giant convention, and, you know, all of them are handshaking and getting along, and then they all go back to their own church. And, you know, our church, we know, though, that every other Southern Baptist church is going to hell, too,
because
we're the only one that got it right.
It's incredible. The sheer sort of, like, you know, pure balls of presuming that your slight variation is the right one. It's amazing. Obviously. I mean, it's majestic, actually, in its kind of pure testicular fortitude.
Lovely. Nice.
Yeah. So, okay. And I'm still trying to wrap my head around the Ukrainian Catholic Greek. Theologically, is it pretty much straight Catholic?
I guess. Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah, you know, it's funny. I wouldn't even be able to tell you the real minutia of the belief. You know, I knew what the services were like, you know, and I know that the Pope was recognized, you know, apart from that, I wouldn't even necessarily be able to tell, you know, like, I have Italian Catholic friends or Roman Catholic friends or whatever. And I their services I would go to that would be in English, if I would happen to be at a church service or something with a friend, they were very different, much more conversational, much more, yeah, just ours was very, very dark, very, a lot of the old traditions kind of sort of thrown in there.
Okay.
The old, not Latin, but sort of based on the old, Slavic sort of, it's called the Staroslavyansky, which is the old Slavic, not Ukrainian, not Russian, not any of those. It's like the base language, though that still crept into it. So, you know, I couldn't understand, even though I spoke Ukrainian so much, and it's all sung for the most part too, or at least sort of has this kind of sing songy quality to it. So that you really don't understand what's being said. Plus the fact that you're in this echoey, you know, church that's covered in mosaic tiles. So there is this just drone nature to it all. So also reading the translation of the Mass years later, I was shocked at, like, that this is, you know, for whatever, 14, 15 years, I was sort of participating, even tacitly participating in this Mass, Saint Basil, I think was the guy that wrote that particular Mass. Just horribleness, you know, the best example being that, you know, like, everything is repeated three times. And then, you know, while you're praying in this litany of prayers that are being spread out, the hierarchy of the entire sort of pyramid scheme is laid out. Cause it's like, first and foremost, we pray for the Pope. That's like the first thing. Then we pray for all the bishops and all the thing. Then we pray for all the metropolitan priests. Then we pray for the other priests. And, like, and then all the way down the list is, like, then we pray for people that are sick or that need, you know, or hungry or whatever. And it's like, really, like, the last bunch, that's who we're praying for at the end of this list. You know, the guy with the gold shoes, he's first, you know, that kind of stuff is just, it was more and more illuminating as I sort of investigated. And as often is the case, the more you study religion, the more it's its own worst enemy in terms of sort of allowing you to leave it and realize the hypocrisy that's there. True study, you know, true unfiltered study tends to sort of allow you to see what's actually going on and provides you an escape vehicle.
Man, at least Steve Martin, it just takes three times. I break with thee, I break with thee, I break with thee, and then you kick dog pee pee on her shoes and you're divorced.
Right, but right.
That's just too much.
Yeah. I mean, Sundays were, you know, I had Ukrainian school on Saturday afternoons or Saturday mornings and then church on Sundays. And I, like, by that point, I was beat. I was just like, can I have a morning? Can I please have one morning, you know? 90-minute service, you know, of droning, so.
Yeah. And was it sit, stand, kneel, or just stand, kneel?
Oh, no, full aerobic, sit, stand, kneel. Nice. Yeah, again, with I've said this before also, but the absolute, you know, and this occurred to me when I was about 13 or 14, you know, the absolute perfect representation of the hypocrisy of, the Western Church, or at least the Catholic Church, from my perspective, is the padded kneeler. You know what I mean? Like in every pew, you have that little thing you pull down, which you kneel on, and it's got a nice little pad on it. So it's like, yeah. So, you know, I'm prostrating myself in front of the Lord, but you want to be comfortable. You know, you want to save your knees. Like, and it's like, do you understand the weird dichotomy of that? Of like, the point is to be uncomfortable and get, you know, to sort of pay for sins or whatever you're doing, get on your knees, you know, but no, we're going to pat it. So that's, yeah, I always love that.
So were you kneeling on the tile?
Oh no, I was barely kneeling. And then it gets to the point now where if for whatever reason I am in a church, I don't even kneel. And it feels great. It feels real. I just sort of, I stand because I do that, but I will not prostrate on my knees. And, you know, in the same way that I don't wear a yarmulke if I go into a synagogue, you know, it's like, I'm not going to participate in your most holy rites. You know, like I'll be there as an observer, because it's my friend's wedding or because it's a funeral or whatever, but I'm not going to participate in the stuff, you know.
It just feels wrong to do it if you don't
believe it. It does. I mean, I talked about this about my uncle's funeral a couple of years ago. Like everyone had to line up and the priest, expected you to kiss the cross that he would hold. Again, this nice bacteriological adventure. But I, you know, I'm like, I'm not going to kiss, you know, even if I didn't have sort of the vehement beliefs that I have in terms of my atheism, I wouldn't want to participate in a sacrament of another organization, especially something that's supposedly that holy, you know? So I kind of turned my head and didn't do it, you know, and it felt oddly, I don't know, liberating and kind of like, yeah. I mean, and I didn't want to be a douchebag about it, but at the same time, I wanted to be like, do you realize how presuming this is, especially at a funeral? It's not even like this is a service. This is like a funeral that is going to expect non-parishioners to attend because they're going to be, you know, coworkers, non-Ukrainians, especially, you know, this is a Ukrainian church. Of a funeral of my uncle. He's going to have his coworkers. He's going to have his, you know, he could have all kinds of religiously or not religiously minded or varying faiths there. And, you know, to presume that everyone's going to line up and kiss the cross as they walk past the casket. It was just, it was awful.
Yeah. And I attended a Catholic service for a church worship ministry class when I was in college that the priests actually did a little speech before communion saying that if you weren't a good Christian in good standing or you were an apostate, to not come forward because it'd bring a curse on you.
Ooh, okay. Well, hey, I'd much rather hear that than feel some like, you know, duty of like, oh, you're going to be embarrassed if you don't get up, you know?
Because if they take it seriously, they should not be encouraging people to take part.
Absolutely. Of the sacrament like that too. That is the whole ball of wax right there. You're going to eat this flesh and drink this blood just casually because everyone else is doing it. It's like, whoa, really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, you just bring up one of those little tiny travel bottles of like Tabasco and say, hey, you know, for my cracker.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good.
But the Catholic and Orthodox way of doing things, the amount of physical involvement you have with the communion every time, with all of the kneeling and standing and aerobics and going forward and going back and kissing things. There is a powerful element to actually engaging your body in it that can really strengthen its holding power.
Oh, of course. That's the whole point. That's the whole thing. I mean, it's all about, especially in the Catholic, especially the Byzantine Catholic thing, this idea of representing, you know, this is the trailer. This whole religious thing, this is the trailer for heaven. This is the preview. This is the sneak peek of what's awaiting you. And that's why it's all covered in gold. And that's why there's all this magisterium and all this mystery, you know. And yeah, you're going to be in vine. Look at, I mean, this is what heaven's going to be like. This is just the preview. You know, we don't even get to see the Hulk turn into the Hulk yet. This is just the trailer, you know, of what's coming up in the feature that's going to be heaven, you know? So yeah, you got to involve the body. You've got to involve, you know, all that kind of stuff that reinforces, you know, that, that idea that if you actually make yourself smile physically, you feel better, you know? Now they obviously don't, you know, the church didn't understand the biomechanics of that, but they understood that there was a definite correlation and a connection to it. So yeah, so if you're kneeling in front of something, if you're prostrating yourself, if you're standing, if you're singing, if you're, I mean, just crossing yourself, you know, these little superstitious things that you gotta do this stuff.
It horribly reinforces itself.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's addicting. And then it's just in the same way that you knock wood, you know, when you say something or whatever it is, it's that same exact part of the human brain, which is trying to correlate, you know, small incidences to some greater thing, which, cause then it makes you feel a little bit more comfortable in the void that is existence.
See, but the church is like, the Ang Lee's Hulk, you know, there's a whole lot of graphics and like no substance at all.
Right.
Whereas
right.
life is more like Deadpool and it's still like, just like awesome and magnificent.
I just saw Deadpool 4 hours ago. I loved it. Very awesome. Fun. Very fun. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't laughed that many times. I've laughed out loud a bunch recently, but I don't think I've laughed that many times out loud at a film in a number of years. And it was very, very, yeah, very enjoyable.
Very gratifying. I just loved it. I mean, they did a really wonderful job. I'm very happy. Can't wait to see the next. Did you see, did you stay to the end for the stinger?
Of course. Okay. Of course. And I actually called it in my brain. I thought, I for whatever reason, I thought Ferris Bueller. Maybe that was just because that's the most famous one. And I always think that subconsciously whenever I'm hanging out afterwards. Totally. But I did think Ferris Bueller. And then as soon as I saw the robe, I just thought, oh, that's great. That's fantastic. Spoiler, by the way. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was so amazing. Loved it. Start to finish.
Yeah, well cast. Really fun. Self-aware. The fourth wall thing wasn't too much. That can get kind of too much if it's done not right. I loved that, you know, they covered his eyes for, three quarters of the film. And it totally worked. I mean, to his credit, to Ryan Reynolds' credit, to be able to be completely covered in that suit and be comfortable and still have enough of the character kind of come through in what, in essence, is a, you know, vocal performance. Yeah, it was very, very satisfying.
Totally. He rocked it.
Yeah.
Dustin probably hasn't seen it.
I did, and we talked about it in the last episode. Oh,
that's right. That's right. You hate the fourth wall.
Yeah. I thought three times was enough, and every time past that just pulled me out of the story.
Oh, yeah.
And ruined it for me.
Have you read the comic?
Yeah. No.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
So that's like an essential part of the actual...
It was a movie made for fans of the comic. Not like most of the superhero movies that are made for the general public.
Yeah.
Now, yes, a lot of people from the general public did enjoy it, but that wasn't the target audience for sure.
I don't know. It's racking up some good sales. And it was an awesome rom-com.
Right.
All right. Well, we're going to take our first break.
Oh, boy.
Atheist Nomads is proudly brought to you by Archway Hosting. Check out their low-price, full-featured hosting solutions at archwayhosting.com. That's A-R-C-H-W-A-Y hosting.com.
Hey, we're also brought to you by listeners just like you. Find out how you can become a patron at patreon.com/atheistnomads. That's patreon.com/atheistnomads.
All right, George, when I interrupted your story, it was to go into more details about the church of your upbringing. You were talking about dating a very religious girl in college.
Yeah.
Start with what flavor of church?
That she was with?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. She was a born-again Christian. And I think a Calvinist, is that what it was locally here? Mm-hmm. Mennonite Calvinist.
Oh, that's right. You're up in PA. Okay.
So
okay.
I'm here in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. So, which is where I went to college as well. So she was an amazing singer, and I kind of was quite, attracted to her voice. She not only sang classical music really well, but she was very interested in performing jazz, and she had an excellent jazz voice. So that was, yeah, and kind of the religious thing was sort of secondary, but then it became kind of a fun distraction almost, or like a project in a weird way. Yeah.
Okay.
But she did have a, she had a good voice.
At least a good smoky jazz voice.
It wasn't a smoky voice, but it was a very pure and very well-trained voice. So she had kind of this classical training, but she could turn off the classical tone like a lot of other singers, especially other singers our contemporaries at school couldn't do. You pretty much – people could do either or, and she could do both really well, which I've always been interested and fascinated by people that can sort of do multiple genres correctly. Like in my in my drumming, I would hope that I could play – some of the most fun days I've ever had performing have been multiple gigs where in the morning I'm playing a jazz brunch where I'm doing, you know, Dave Brubeck covers, and in the afternoon is a festival with a hard rock trio playing Police tunes and AC/DC songs, and then at night doing a classical concert or doing, you know, funk songs where I'm doing Motown and R&B, and have the playing be, you know, stylistically as accurate as it can be, as much as I can possibly hope it to be. That to me is the fun thing. And, you know, the word, not that I am, but the word virtuoso is thrown around a lot, and a true virtuoso can play on their instrument in any sort of style. So that to me is really exciting and appealing. And she had for her lack of experience in terms of in performing jazz, she could really turn on that part of her vocal training and turn off the part that would interfere with that. And that was very attractive to me.
Badass.
And then it was like, you know, and I was this bad, you know, bad student, atheist guy. So there was a mutual sort of opposites attraction thing going on. Yeah.
So you were the bad boy. All right.
In some ways, yeah. But you know, I was the bad boy, in a suit. So it was tempered, you know, like I knew how to behave in front of parents, but I was, yeah, but I had the bad boy ideas happening anyway. So yeah, it was mutually beneficial for a while until it wasn't, but I did get to read the Bible top to bottom. So that was good.
Nice. And you did that for her?
Well, it was, yeah, it was sort of trying to involve myself in her world somewhat. And, yeah, and then trying to convince her that we could proceed in some way, even though there was no way we could. But I was trying to convince both myself and her that we could do it, and that was one way that I was trying to convince her. I would, you know, read stuff and we'd talk about it, but it, you know, it did much of the opposite, where it was just like, have you read the Old Testament? This is some horrible stuff. And the New Testament isn't that much better, really. This is some bad stuff, man. And then this contradicts this, and then this doesn't make sense with this other thing. And they said this before, but now they're saying this. Like, which one is it supposed to be? Yeah, so.
It's a lot like comic books. They're always trying to reinvent stuff or like ignore the past that didn't happen. And yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's cool. Yeah. Yeah. Which again, it's storytelling. You know, you recognize that this is, you know, what it is. It is storytelling. And this is, you know, in the same way that the Iliad and the Odyssey, I mean, we could have just as easily had a religion based on that, yeah, or that would have been
a cool one.
Yeah, or Gilgamesh, or who knows what. You know, these are just stories that have been repackaged and are prone to all of the same fallacies as and delicate human failings as any other stories, especially ones from a Bronze Age culture. So, yeah.
We actually do have a religion that's loosely based off of the Odyssey.
Do we?
Christianity. The Gospel of Mark is written with Jesus and stories about Jesus following the Odyssey formula that the author would have learned Greek writing. The main way they taught Greek back then was, or how to read and write it, was reading the Odyssey and writing the Odyssey and then writing stories in the style of the Odyssey. And he wrote a gospel following the plot of the Odyssey.
Really?
Yeah. That's one of the best explanations for it. Yeah.
Or is that the strength of sort of human storytelling tends to follow these, you know, Conradian arcs, you know? Is that something that's baked into our brains in terms of how you tell a story?
I think it's more there are certain stories that survive and inspire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Odyssey did that for the ancient world. A lot of Shakespeare does that now.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
When you get some of those stories, like how many different tellings of Hamlet are there in different forms and stories that it's not about Hamlet, but it's the same story.
Sure. Yeah. What was it? They say there's seven plots basically or something.
Yeah.
Something like there's nine plots. Yeah, sure.
The basic romantic comedy dates back to ancient Greece.
Right. But I wonder how many of those things are sort of baked into us from, you know, sitting around the campfire, even that there's even a more basic, you know, maybe there's really two stories, you know, you either stay home or you leave, you know, some, and that's it. There's like the variations of those or what, you know, whatever it may be. So yeah, I wonder if it's a not coincidental, but it's an incidental similarity between the Odyssey and what those writers were doing, or, as opposed to like, hey, I'm going to use the outline of the Odyssey to do it. So, but I've never heard that before. I have to look into that. That's interesting. And yeah. I wouldn't doubt it because there's so much that's borrowed from previous cultures, you know, the flood myths, the resurrection myths, the virgin births, all, I mean, it's the same resurrected stories over and over, kind of repackaged, repolished, which is, we're still doing today until you get Deadpool talking to the camera. So,
well, there's, I heard recently about, either How Stuff Works or Stuff You Missed in History Class, one of those two podcasts, they were talking about fairy tales. And like the traditional fairy tales, there's somebody who's doing work tracing their lineages back. And a lot of them, based on where they find the same story, more or less, probably date back to having been originally told or written in Indo-European, like Proto-Indo-European.
Mm-hmm.
Dating back that far.
Sure. Yeah. I wouldn't doubt it. Look, it's incredible how much we are the same exact animal that we were, what, 60,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago? I mean, we're identical. We're identical. We wouldn't, you know, if you were to transport one of us in time and put us on the savannah, you know, you wouldn't stand out. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, apart from your iPhone, you wouldn't stand out, you know? I mean, and we forget that those pre-cultures that were formulating all that stuff had the same sized brain, had the same capacity, and had the same wants and needs and desires and ability to formulate all the same stuff we do now. It's just we tend to, you know, now we can build upon the knowledge that's come before because we've got writing, you know. Totally. But
it's just accumulated knowledge. I mean,
accumulated, but it's incredible that the animal is identical. So of course they're going to be, you know, looking at the stars and thinking. That's why, like, I think skeptics and atheists and science-minded and evidence-based people and creatures have been around since the absolute dawn. And for whatever reason, because the repositories of knowledge tended to be based around, you know, religious institutions, I think that's why we got sort of the short shrift in the historical records. But I think people were just as suspicious of the shaman, you know, doing some kind of a trick with a, you know, a lit stick. We're just, you know, whatever, 10, 15, 20% of them were just as eyebrow raising and going, wait a minute, what? Nah, that's bullshit. Wait a minute. As we are today, I'm convinced of it. And I think that's one of the most sort of interesting and fascinating things about our past, cultures is to investigate that 20% that was saying, no, you know, Jennifer Hecht had that great book called Doubt that, talks about how there is this thread throughout all of civilization of people going, wait, what? And it's so encouraging and wonderful.
I've always thought that, you know, if you didn't have the church pimping afterlife all the time and getting so many donations and, you know, if we had some more, you know, maybe science sleep, more literate people in science or reading back in the, you know, a few centuries. Well, Michelangelo probably wouldn't have been making great works for the church. He might have still been doing great things for, well, you know, sciencey things.
Sure. I mean, well, if the caliphate hadn't changed in whatever that was, I don't know the exact dating, but in terms of the advances that were being made in the Middle East in terms of mathematics, and chemistry, algebra, all that stuff, those advances were crazy. And they basically stopped because it was before the Crusades. It's when the caliphate changed, and it changed from this acceptance of science and acceptance of
giant distrust of it
to a giant. Yeah, it sort of, I mean, it was almost within a generation. It sort of turned on a dime where that stuff wasn't encouraged anymore. And if that hadn't happened, that part of the world would have been 1500 to 2000 years ahead of where we are today technologically, because you wouldn't have had sort of the loss of all of that stuff. It wouldn't have had to sit dormant for whatever that was, 900, 1200 years until Europeans came back and found all this stuff.
Look at Iran. I mean, from 1960, it was kind of hard to tell it apart from
that too. Jeez. Now, yeah. Especially
in the 70s. It was just hijabs everywhere.
No, I saw Tyson, Neil deGrasse Tyson did a great talk at TAM years ago, and he did the keynote, and he talked about this sort of loss, this, you know, there's a billion Muslims on the planet now. And he says, like, how many Einsteins are in that billion? Yeah. Not that are, you know, actively Einsteins, but are the equivalent of Einstein. Just from a pure mathematical perspective, there's got to be a bunch. You know, and yet it's not being fostered, let alone the billions that have lived and died, in the last 2000, 3000, 3,500 years. The scientific geniuses that kind of came and went because the environment and the culture was not designed to foster that. You know, think of the achievements, again, just from a pure mathematical and statistical standpoint. If, you know, Einstein comes along, what, one in 5 billion people is an Einstein, or is a whatever the, you know, equivalent would be. Mathematically, that has to happen if you have 5, 6, 10 billion people that have lived at some point. And his point was like, yeah, if this hadn't changed, think of the advances. And isn't that something we should be working on to be inclusive, to allow those statistical geniuses to reach their potential? It was a really cool way to look at it.
Well, and what really sucks with that is it could have changed if not for the Crusades, which made them even more distrustful of everything. And then Genghis Khan came in and literally burned down the universities.
Yeah. Yeah.
They haven't recovered from that.
Yeah, sure. Sure. But I think even before that, they definitely
started way before, but whatever trends were going on, it was just completely solidified. And within a 500 year time span, they were stuck.
Yeah.
There was no coming back from that.
It's actually amazing that as much of that knowledge was sort of retrieved as it was during the Renaissance and all that kind of stuff. And that it was allowed to. That's also a pretty interesting, that the sort of the educational and advancing environment allowed for that kind of classical training to be rediscovered and embraced and advanced upon. It's again, it's like two steps forward, you know, 15 steps back sometimes. But when you get those two steps, it feels really great. And then all of a sudden, that also proves the appeal and the facility that science and the scientific method has within it inherently, that if it's allowed to foster, like, get out of the way, because boy, it's just going to take off. It's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Look at medieval Europe. They burned all the ancient philosophy and science, burned the books. The Renaissance, a lot of it was thanks to copies of the Greek philosophies preserved by Arabs.
Right, right. Exactly.
Yeah, and probably so, wouldn't even know much about Hypatia at all if it hadn't been for them.
Yeah, it could have been another 1,000 years before that stuff was sort of rediscovered or refigured out. So yeah, no, it's amazing. But again, that's the strength of the, you know, of the process and the method, which again conflicts and contrasts with finding ancient religious texts, you know, like the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Apocrypha or whatever. Or you might find some ancient religious text. Relic or something, and it's like, okay, that's cool, but there's no advancement made within the philosophical understandings of what the religion is supposedly trying to achieve. Whereas with science, like, you find some old science formula, or you find some old scientific method, or you find, you know, Greek, you find, you know, the writings of Pericles, or you find the Pythagorean theorem buried in a, you know, clay pot somewhere, you know, it will advance exponentially. It still works. Yeah. And there's this exponential advancement in terms of architecture and mathematics and all this kind of stuff that would, you know, that is inherent within the validity of the discovery that's there, as opposed to some kind of, oh, you know, story about begatting.
Yeah. Although what sucks, like with Pythagoras, yeah, they found his theorem. They also found his metaphysical writings. Which would have been just as destructive as any other religious text. Fortunately, but, you know, that one didn't take hold.
Right. What, you know, what rises, you know, the cream gets to the top, and it's like, hey, wait, we can actually use this to build bridges and shit. So it's like, okay, awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. And
there's,
like,
there's been some really famous inventors over time that thought they could turn lead into gold too, but you know,
Yeah. Right, but they couldn't, you know. So you discover those writings, and you try to replicate using the process. You replicate their experiments, and it doesn't work. And you go like, "All right, this doesn't work."
Yeah.
Eventually, we will be able to, but it'll be completely pointless because it'll cost so much money to split off that many protons.
It won't matter then because we won't be using money then. Because Star Trek.
That's right. Pressed latinum.
Gold pressed latinum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Star Trek currency would not exist without without gold. Mm-hmm. Even if it is just the casing.
I don't know. We'll find a way. Maybe. I don't know. People just find ways to make that show just count. And like they're freaking building tricorders, or trying to. I mean, there's an X Prize for that, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
I think we'll get there before we realize we have it, and it'll be so much better. Well, maybe not quite. Some of it I don't know if we'll quite get to, like some of that scanning capability, but
give us time.
We're already getting pretty close to being able to do that with a smartphone.
Yeah.
A lot of that.
It's always so incremental. It's always incremental. And so the incremental change is never quite as drastic as the sudden, you know, invention in your hand, or the fictionalized version of the thing. Whereas you get with, you know, 10% of the thing, and then you get 22% of the thing, and then 40% of the thing. And then before you know it, you've got 98% of the thing, but it's not nearly as cool as just having 98% of the thing.
Yeah.
But that's always the way it works. It's always like, oh yeah, we totally have these things, like, you know, like the smartphone is a perfect example.
Oh,
you
sure.
Know, it's great.
It's an evolution.
But it's an evolution. Yeah. And you sort of realize, wow, like this, gosh, in my hand, I have, you know, more information available than, you know, President Clinton had access to.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, Caterpillar company just put out a smartphone that has a integrated FLIR, you know, thermal imaging in it.
Where
I think it's really going to take off isn't going to be with like going the tricorder route. It's going to be, at least for medicine, bionics. Have a monitor inside of you that reports the data back and can provide so much better information. If you can read hormone levels and chemical levels, you've got 90% of the data.
Right.
The only thing more you would ever need would be the occasional scanning.
Yeah, I think you'll have nanobots, you know, swimming through you that'll be able to report to a centralized device saying that, you know, oh, there's a blockage here, or there's a temperature change here, or there's an enzymatic problem over here. And we'll
just it'll be able to repair that blockage.
And then, yeah, and then just repair it too.
That'll be the next generation will be able to repair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah. Keep all I just blanked on that word. Veins all cleaned out and
right.
Your pancreas working and yeah.
All right. So, commercial break?
We've missed too many.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll throw in the third one now.
If you like the show, consider giving us some financial support. We make it really easy with one-time donations or to support us on a per episode, monthly, or even annual basis using PayPal or Patreon. Find out more at atheistnomads.com. Use the links on the right side of the page. $1 an episode is all we ask. Please think of the kittens.
All right.
Do you think of the kittens? What you been up to lately? I mean,
you're what have I been up?
Yeah. And I it was a couple months ago, but I just heard you on Incredulous. That's
all. I did that. Yeah, that was a couple months back. I did that. Yeah, it's a slightly slow time now for the band. I had a premiere of the Broad Street Score, which I did back in January. That was a kind of a greatest hits 20th anniversary concert, it was a string quartet versions of songs of mine that I've written over the last 20 years. That's something I'm going to be doing at Nexus, actually, which is going to be really fun. Thursday, May 12th at the Northeast Conference for Science and Skepticism. I'll be doing the New York premiere of that piece, which will be really fun. Just plugging away. And I just had my ninth year of podcasting, episode 450 I'll record tomorrow. So
wow.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Holy crap. I thought we were doing good. What are you, like 134, 35?
This is 135.
Okay. Nice. Nice.
Oh my goodness. That is awesome. 450. Yeah. You go, man.
Yeah,
another 450.
Yeah. I never thought I'd get to here. Not that I was ever even wanted to, but yeah, somehow 9 years later, it's crazy. First episode was.
You're one of those amazing first generation podcasters.
I guess I'm first generation. There's a couple guys that have like the SGU had their 10th anniversary, and there's another guy that's been doing it for I think like almost 12 years. But yeah, I was in pretty early.
Yeah.
Did you actually get inspired by the SGU, or did you just like get into it?
No, I was inspired by Skepticality originally. Nice. And by my friend Slough. Slough is the guy that I record all my albums at his studio. He's an engineer, he's a musician and a composer as well. And he's visually impaired, so he was on the podcast train right from the beginning, because pretty much all of his sort of entertainment is done through audio. So he suggested I listen to Skepticality, and which I did. I sent them some stuff. They interviewed me, and that kind of started it. And then a year or so later after that, he sort of said, hey, you should really do one of these. And so I thought, okay, I could probably do one of these. So let me give it a shot. I'll do 50, and I'll see what happens. And here we are, 9 years later.
Well, you do give really good voice.
Oh, thank you.
Man. And you started well before that, college days. You started what, as a DJ?
I had a little silly radio show. Like, you know, that's kind of the rule. When you go to college, you have to have a radio show. So I did that. Just kind of talking about stuff. Yeah, pre-podcast, I guess. Playing tunes occasionally, but then just sort of talking about things, telling stories. Yeah, that was Tuesday nights after astronomy class. I remember I'd fall asleep in astronomy class, wake up just in time for that to end, and then go do my show at WMRC. Yeah.
Very nice. I slept in astronomy class as well.
It was tough because it was at night, you know, it was like late. So like, you know, I'd be shot from the day, and then you'd have I think we had a 2.5 hour astronomy class. I'd just be, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Remember, like, mine was only 50 minutes, and it was at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, wow. All right.
But the teacher was pretty boring, and he would turn off the lights, and it was in this big auditorium.
Yeah.
With like 30 people in there, and I couldn't stay awake.
That's well, it.
At that point, he's just daring you to sleep. Come on.
Right.
Yeah.
Lights go off. That's it.
And I would do my homework and then fall asleep.
Yeah.
I would sit and write out Frank Zappa lyrics to stay awake. So I just had notebooks full of, I would think of every possible Frank Zappa and Yes lyric I could remember and just write them out. And just so it looked like I was taking notes, but I was just sort of transcribing from memory what I could. And that would keep me awake. Yeah. It's a good use of my parents' money.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, oh man. All right. So I'm still tense. Anyways, I'm too tense.
Sometimes. Why are you tense?
Oh, just writing. I just got into motorcycle riding, so I'm like full on motorcycle riding. So this is, I don't know.
It's what fun, kind of it's, what kind of bike? What are you, like this motocross or Harleys or what?
It reminiscent of Harley. I don't know. You call it a cruiser. It's okay. A 2005 Kawasaki Vulcan, kind of a big bike, mid-size, I suppose, for a cruiser, about 500 pounds, 800cc, and it's all kind of fun, but going from a scooter to that, really, it's a bit of a jump.
What kind of scooter did you have?
A Vespa clone.
Really?
Yeah. It's called the Genuine Stella, and... Yeah, it looks like a little Vespa PX.
Oh, that's I've awesome. Seen those. Yeah. I've wanted a Vespa for a long time and just haven't quite gotten around to getting one. But
oh, my goodness, they're so much fun.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
It's silly. It's fun. I get about 90 miles to a gallon.
Maybe yeah.
Over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow.
Honda's got a really cool little Vespa-ish kind of, I forget what it's called. Mm. I almost got one of those. There's a guy around town that drives one, and there's just something about it. It's just really nice. So, yeah, I would totally, totally get one of them.
I don't mind being that guy. You know, people that ride scooters somehow have a stigma to me, but, or at least they did when I was growing up. I always mm-hmm. liked that, but I don't want to be that guy. And right. Now I give zero fucks. I like being that guy.
Yeah, why not?
I even strapped a little milk cart to the back.
Nice. Yeah. Awesome. So why did you decide to go up to the bike?
Well, highway riding, that's a big thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, long periods, go on big rides, maybe down the Coast 101.
Nice. Do you need a license for that, or is that a separate thing? How's that work?
For at least in Washington State, as I recall it, it's 149 cc and below, you do not need a motorcycle endorsement.
Okay.
But I got mine anyways.
And is it like a test? Is it a driving test, or how does that work? Is that a written thing or a combination?
Personally, I took a basic rider's course for motorcycles, and then that you have a actual motorcycle driving test and a written test at the same time. And
while driving? Oh my gosh, that must be tough.
It ain't that bad. You know, you no, just kidding. Learn to balance.
Right.
And then, yeah, you just show a little card to the DMV and pay them cool. a little bit of extra money, and there you go.
Nice. Nice. All right. But
one thing that's probably a factor in him deciding to upgrade like that would be the fact that between him and his girlfriend, there's a bridge. It's the only way across the water. And it's a freeway.
That is true. Oh, I see. All right. True. All right.
And it's the famous Tacoma Narrows Bridge with some insane winds, and I would be terrified to go across that thing on a scooter.
That is true. Have you ever seen those old movies of the galloping Gertie, the bridge just
walking?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's this bridge.
Oh nice. Okay.
Granted, you know, the taking it down replaced it, but yeah.
So you increased your CCs, so you can get some more C. That's very nice. Not to cast aspersion on your girlfriend.
No.
That's terrible. Sorry.
No.
Apologies to her and her family.
Oh, boy.
We love hearing from our listeners. You can email us at contact@atheistnomads.com, tweet us @atheistnomads, send us a message on our Facebook page at facebook.com/atheistnomads, or better yet, call us and leave us a message at 541-203-0666.
We might even play it on the show. You can also help us out by leaving us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcast directory of choice.
So what kind of hobbies do you have? What do you like to do?
Hobbies. Gosh, who has time for hobbies? It's funny.
Always working out. You're always doing playing.
But. That's the thing. Yeah. It's like if I have free time, I'm going to go for a run. I'm going to exercise. I'm going to try to write a song. I'm going to try to go for a walk. I mean, I love walking. I just, any chance I get to be outside and go into the woods somewhere, like I think that might be considered a hobby. I guess what, movies, going to films, is a hobby, I guess. I don't know. I've always wanted to build trains. I always wanted to have a train set. I never had a train set, and I picture myself at some point in the next 20 years having a train set. So when I do that, I will let you know, because that'll be the official hobby. I want to make an HO scale, you know, perfectly to scale. I don't know. Maybe I'll make a little miniature Bethlehem or something. But I always loved train sets that were done right, that were to scale. I used to make model airplanes and tanks and stuff when I was a kid, and I'd make little dioramas. I always liked that, but I haven't flexed those muscles in quite a long time. So maybe at some point, once the music industry totally dies, I'll be able to, once the live music industry totally folds in upon itself, and is swallowed by a DJ, a Godzilla sized DJ, I'll make a little train set here, and that'll be fun. But otherwise it's you know, reading the books, going on hikes, doing what, push-ups and jumping rope, and then trying to become a better guitar player and a better piano player and a better drummer and a better singer. Those are my hobbies.
Very nice.
Well, you're pretty much kicking my ass already, so.
Well, it's
you're seriously always busy, and you know, the world's better for it.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say. Thank you.
Well, come on. You're kind of a hero of mine, so I'm fanboying a little bit.
Oh my gosh, that's very nice. Oh. Now, I'm always curious. How did you discover my stuff, my junk here, as it were?
Well, honestly, just searching for skeptic or atheist podcasts.
Oh, really?
But I've also picked up a fair piece about music over the years also because of you. And granted, I don't play at all, but I find it interesting, and it's, you know, it really helps me have a lot better conversations with my girlfriend, actually, because she loves the indie music.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, it's always a fun challenge to try to explain musical things to in non-musical ways, you know, non-specific or non-technical ways. It's always there's something up, it's like a weird puzzle, you know, to be able to describe or explain a musical concept.
You know, like holding your sticks when you're drumming, there's like the over and under was what I understand.
I guess, yeah. Did I talk about, is that a reference to something I said, or yeah, I'm not even sure. But, you know, it's that sort of thing of like, oh, this is, yeah, imagine a wall of bricks and the alternating bricks or something, you know, like, to explain some kind of musical concept without using musical terms is always fun. And I've been surprised that I'd probably say half of the questions I get on the segment called Ask George on my show which is just a question an answer thing, are musically related. People asking, you know, what is this thing I heard? What's going on in this song? Or what do you think about this artist? Or what do you think about this album or whatever? I never quite expected for that to be as much of what I talked about in that segment. That and clothing. It's funny that it's almost half and half clothing, half music. So, which is, I'm totally fine with, but that has been a surprising thing. So I'm glad you've been able to communicate more with your girlfriend about music, if only slightly because of what I've done. So that's great.
I've also learned to wear bright socks.
Very nice. Thank you. Excellent. Excellent. Well, then my job is done.
Yes.
Now I can build trains.
Joss Whedon, Much Ado About Nothing. Have you seen it?
No, I did not. And I meant to. I think I had even rented it once and then didn't get around to actually watching it. But I heard it's very enjoyable.
Nathan Fillion, everybody, cast is amazing.
Yeah. See it. Okay. I don't know if it's on Netflix, but I'll go hunt for it. That'll be a nice Sunday afternoon at some point. Yes. Now, what do you like most about it?
I love that this was just a bunch of friends that they would do Much Ado About Nothing scenes at Joss's house on occasion, and they just thought that they should, you know, put this on film. Everybody, you know, they've known each other for a long time. They would just improvise scenes, and everything is filmed at Joss's house.
Right.
And you know that these people are friends and that they have a really good connection between them. And it
so it's the rapport, camera. The rapport, oh, yeah, that you enjoy. Okay. Now, why is that, do you think? Why is rapport so enjoyable to watch?
Why isn't it? I mean, you can tell when people get along and when they don't, but you know, it just gives that sense of feeling of a belonging or family or friendship.
Mm-hmm. And but watching people not get along is fun also. Sometimes
it can be, but
yeah, it's a different thing, right?
I'm not much of a train wreck kind of person.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, reality TV show, any of that. I haven't really watched broadcast TV for well over a decade. So that's just really not a thing that I'm interested in. But man, yeah, just a really good friendship, a good dynamic between people. Love it.
Is it because it makes it feel like it's possible, or is it because it's like a fantasy thing? Like I'm actually genuinely curious. I'm wondering, because I'm the same way. I love watching competent people do stuff. I love watching people get along. And yeah, rapport is a very attractive thing. And like, why is it? Do you imagine placing yourself within that situation and hoping, or is it like, oh, look, they can do it in their existence. Maybe I can do it in mine. Is it I'm curious.
Well, I mean, it's Shakespeare, first of all, so it's something that I've read in the past, and, you know, being able to see them take a new, more of a current twist on things.
Right.
I mean, it's, I don't know, it has a passion, a flavor of a speed that a lot of people won't. Directors wouldn't necessarily take.
Right. Well, I'll have to check it out. Sounds really cool. Yeah. I just remember reading reviews and just seeing some clips and thinking, oh, this looks really cool. I will definitely check it out.
Yes, please. Now that we have you on here.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
I've never really heard you cuss. What's your favorite swear word?
Well, my favorite swear word is actually a Ukrainian word.
Okay.
And well, it's the curse word that my mom's father would say. And it's cholera, which is cholera.
Right.
And it was so sort of imbued within the culture, I guess, that it was used as a curse word. Like, you would, you know, like, what in the name of cholera is going on? You know, and I used to love to hear him say, you know, cholera, cholera, you know, that this thing could be a cholera, you know, like the stupid lock on the door wouldn't lock. And he would just say, like, you know, God, this thing is being a cholera. I used to love that. So that, I think that's my favorite curse word. But it's not really a curse word, but for him and for me, it always was. So.
Yeah. Nice. And I sent you an email to try and get this all going here, and I was talking to you about food just a little bit, like pierogies for me, a Polish food. Mm-hmm. And you have like a, did you get raised up with a Ukrainian version of it?
Oh yeah, it's called pirohi. I mean, it's the same thing basically, and it's that. Yeah, I mean, every culture has its dumplings.
Yeah,
and ours, you know, the Eastern European thing are these pierogies or pirohi, which that's either, you know, potato stuffed or sauerkraut stuffed. Mm-hmm. There was a dessert version too that was kind of a blueberry stuffed. But Christmas Eve was a big. We call it the big beige food festival. There's no protein, which is very interesting, but it's stuffed cabbage. It's the pierogies, the pirohi. Yeah. I mean, growing up, my mom's mom, could make, Pirohe like a machine, and they were they were fantastic. And my mom still has the recipe, and I've actually made them as well. A couple Christmases ago, I made a bunch, and I've made another thing that are called ushke, which literally is ears. It translates to ears, and they're smaller stuffed ravioli type things, but it's with mushrooms, chopped and seasoned mushrooms, and you put those into borscht, the beet soup, which, you know, Ukrainians eat borscht warm, hot. Yeah. You know, Russian borscht is usually room temperature. Ukes, at least at least from my upbringing, we had it pretty hot, and then especially Christmas Eve, you put the ushka in there, the ear dumplings, and very 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 yummy.
So your pierogies, though, were they boiled or baked?
Either way, I mean, usually boiled. If you're making them like, if you're making them to eat them right then and there, you would boil them. But like the next day, if you had leftovers, fry them up in a pan.
Oh my gosh, nice and crispy.
Oh, yeah. That's it. That's it, man.
The first day is great, but a little bit of bacon grease in a frying pan the day after is just so amazing.
Oh yeah, you get a little bit of you know, caramelization happening on it, a little bit of crusting, and it's quite lovely, quite lovely.
Man, what about galumkis? Have you ever heard of this?
Well, is that would be like holubtsi? I would think it would be our thing, which is that's the stuffed cabbage.
We would do cabbage rolls.
Cabbage rolls, yeah. So stuffed with rice and rice, we'll call them holubtsi.
Maybe beef.
Yeah. Right. Not so much the beef thing, but it was my mom makes those for Christmas Eve as well. And, she got to the point where she could make the cabbage nice and kind of still, al dente. It wasn't totally soggy, because if it's too soggy, it gets a bit mushy. She learned this process of kind of undercooking that stuff, and you get this nice, not crispy, but there's a bite to it, a little bit of a firmness to it. And that's just wonderful stuff. Yeah. Just wonderful.
This is so
awesome. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
That and stuffed puppers. Oh my goodness. we used to do plum dumplings. Just roll out like little 8-inch round tortilla size pieces of dough, a plum, a little bit of sugar, a little.
Nice. Oil them. Nice.
I don't know. I'm. You can tell I'm hungry now. But.
Yeah, I haven't had dinner yet either. So yeah, great.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, the Polish and Ukrainian thing, it's very similar. I mean, it's even language wise, because my parents are from Western Ukraine on the border of Poland. Mm-hmm. The language that we speak, which is the Western Ukrainian from the 40s, sounds more Polish than the current Ukrainian sounds. Like current Ukrainian now from Ukraine, especially from the eastern parts of Ukraine, sounds very Russian to me. And I took a couple of years of Russian in high school, and it's hard for me to understand sometimes people that have come over recently from Ukraine. And to them, it sounds like I'm speaking Polish. So it's a softer kind of, it's interesting. So I can understand much more Polish than I sometimes think I can, because of the sort of situational language that my parents were raised speaking, which was this kind of somewhat modified Ukrainian, Western Ukrainian / Polish thing. So yeah. But you know, to me, it's Ukrainian, and anything else sounds Russian.
Well, and a lot of that would probably have to do with, you know, some of the old empires, definitely the whole Russian shift of the last 60 years, 70 years.
Well, yeah. I mean, the whole Soviet, I mean, you know, that was part of the whole diaspora over here of the Ukrainian culture that was in the States. You know, we were doing all the Ukrainian stuff because we honestly didn't know if there was going to be a Ukraine, because the Soviet Union, you know, you weren't allowed to speak Ukrainian. All the schools were Russian. All the churches were switching over to Russian. Any kind of Ukrainian language stuff that was happening in Ukraine from, you know, 1945 to 1991, in essence, was minimized and was illegal in many ways. So it was like our job, you know, and this was pounded into us. And this is why, you know, I was going to Ukrainian school. This is why I was going to Yuki Scouts. So there was and the Ukrainian church, there was a certain guilt of like, hey, it is your job, because odds are this, you know, there's not going to be a Ukraine in another 20 years. Yeah. So that was unique to at least my diasporal experience. And I think that's why it was slightly different than, you know, my Italian friends or my Spanish friends who maybe had a grandmother that spoke Italian or Spanish, but they didn't quite have the same kind of fear that their culture was, you know, on the path to being erased.
You might have something more in common with like your Jewish friends then, where
absolutely, yeah, keep yeah, sure,
alive,
and totally, in terms, of, especially you know, from the 40s or 50s, yeah. But in the midst of the Cold War, in the midst of the you know the evil empire, I mean, God, if you had asked me at you know as late as 1988, 87, you know. In 3 years, will the Soviet Union fall without a single shot being fired? I would have said no fucking way. Like no way at all. Never. And then it happened so quick. I mean, I was over there in 87. And then by the time I was a freshman in high school, it's like, I remember waking up my dad when, the attempted coup happened, when they displaced Gorbachev and the Politburo kind of tried to get rid of him. And then Yeltsin stepped in and he was just like, nope, not going to happen. I remember waking up my dad saying, hey, they just kicked out Gorbachev. And like, even then we didn't think, oh, this is the start of something. It was just like, oh, it's business as usual. You know, Gorbachev has come in.
Get selected.
That was, Gorbachev came in, tried to open up some things and they're going to get rid of him, but they couldn't do it because they couldn't control the information. You know, like people ask, what was the cause of the fall of the Soviet Union? And it wasn't Reagan. It wasn't the Pope. It was the goddamn fax machine, you know? It was the fax machine because you couldn't control the information. CNN was literally getting faxes from people saying like, no, this is what's happening, you know?
Oh, wow.
It's amazing. Again, the technology running and determining history. And once you can't disseminate and control the information, you're fucked. And it's exactly what they learned. That's why all these, you know, regimes now, first thing they want to do is shut down the internet and shut down Twitter and shut down all that stuff. Because if you control information, you can control people and communication, especially. So
the Egyptian government was overthrown by Facebook and Twitter.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the future. You know, I think that's what gives me a little bit of hope even as bad as things are in some places is that you can't continually do it. You can't continually do it to the extent that you were able to control it 50, 100, 200 years ago, whatever, let alone even 10 years ago. So, you know, I think the revolutions that are going to happen in the next, not even century, I mean, in the next decade are going to be all informationally based. And, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. So to be raised speaking Ukrainian with the idea, you know, my sister jokingly said when the Soviet Union dissolved, my sister jokingly said, can we speak English now? You know, which was only half true. I mean, it's like we did our job. It was kind of cool, you know? So that was the purpose. Yeah.
I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on the current Ukrainian civil war.
You know, that's the next thing is like, I had to almost divest myself because I was just burnt out. You know, when the whole Maidan thing happened, 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, whatever that was, I've been burnt so many times, you know, Soviet Union falls. Hey, free Ukraine. Awesome. We did it. You know, celebration. Yay. Within 5 years, it's like covered in corruption and all kinds of horribleness. And they're trying to depose and get rid of people. And then there was the Orange Revolution that happened about whatever that was 10 years ago. And it was like, yay, Yushchenko's in there and they got rid of him. And then they poisoned him and he got, you know, and it's like, and then your heart breaks again. And then something else happens. And then, oh, that thing falls apart and your heart breaks again. And then this whole Maidan thing started happening. And then the Crimean invasion. And I had to be like, I can't. I'm done. Like my cousin conversely, like completely got into it and was watching CNN 24 hours a day and was online, was watching the live satellite camera feed from Kyiv and ended up doing this entire art project about it that was beautiful and just moving. But I kind of had to go, I'm out. I can't have my heart broken again. I sort of realized that I have less to do with the Ukrainians that are there now than I ever have. And I can't. So I check in occasionally, but I have friends that are very into it and I totally understand them being into it. But, yeah, I'm like, it's like a bad relationship. I just have to kind of walk away at this point. Maybe at some point I'll jump back in, or maybe I'll be like, you know, the person that becomes the fan when their team enters the Super Bowl, when there's good news. But I at this point now, I had to divest myself of the emotional part of it, because I can't have my heart broken again, which I know is going to happen, you know, for as much good news and as much bad news that kind of comes out of there, you know. I mean, Chernobyl happens when I'm a kid. Oh, that's, yeah, it's everything. Like, yeah, even before the Soviet Union falls, you know, it's like the first knowledge people have of Ukraine being its own place is when the worst nuclear accident in the history of the planet happens, you know, in essence, in my hometown. It's like, oh, great. So, yeah. So that's the history, the twisted history I have with my culture and my people. And I just, by this point, I was like, I can't. So we'll see. Ask me again in a year. We'll see what happens.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
But safe to say it's a fucked up situation.
Oh, it's completely fucked up. It's incredibly fucked up. Yeah, it's incredibly fucked up and just sad and just, and I, for, you know, from what I know of what's going on, it's hard to imagine there being a solution without a lot of pain and suffering. But yeah. I said that in 1987 as well. So who knows? Who knows?
Yeah, you know, there's already been a lot of pain and suffering and bloodshed.
Oh, God. Yeah. 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 So we'll see. We'll see.
All right. Well, we are out of time.
Yeah.
And you're both hungry.
Yes. Yeah.
So what do you have to plug?
Hey, if you go to geologicpodcast.com, you can come hear my show. If you go to georgehrab.com, or if you just Google HRAB, you can sort of find out what I'm all about. You can get my tunes on my music on iTunes. And if you happen to be in New York City in May, especially May 12th, you should come to Nexus. NECSS.org, because it's a wonderful conference. Bill Nye is talking, and Richard Weissman is going to be giving a keynote, and it's going to be a wonderful weekend. And we kick off the entire weekend with my composition called The Broad Street Score, which is a 20 years worth of music repackaged and represented. So come to that. Otherwise, just go to, you know, The Skeptic's Guide. Because they're much better than any of us. So there you go.
All right. And the links to all that will be in the show notes.
Fantastic.
All righty. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, and guys. It was fun.
For our listeners, we'll be back next week with news.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads, and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.